It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk about how homeless people can be overlooked by the rest of a community. First, we turn our eyes to the road as we explore how cars, from the Model T to ride-hailing apps, have shaped our economy, our infrastructure, and our culture. According to our next guest, how we understand history and make sense of our dependence on automobiles will decide what our culture and a driverless future might look like. Dan Albert is a writer who covers cars for N+1 magazine. He's the author of Are We There Yet? The American Automobile, Past, Present, and Driverless. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Happy to be with you.
How unique is America's relationship to cars compared to other countries?
That's a very good question. I think we see, as other countries develop an automobile culture and kind of catch up with the United States, particularly in places like China, India, that in some ways we're no different. People love cars. People want roads. People enjoy the freedom of being able to get in a vehicle and go where they want, when they want. The biggest difference in the United States, I think, is twofold. One is we became a mass automobile society a generation or more before anybody else. So by the 1920s, America was a full-blown car culture, a motorized society. The other thing is that Detroit, the domestic auto companies, really built the economy. In other words, by selling cars and also all of the economic activity around transforming the country for cars generated an enormous amount of wealth. And then during the Second World War, really in a lot of ways you could say Detroit won the war. We were the arsenal democracy. We sent ships built on an assembly line. We sent airplanes. We sent all kinds of equipment to the war, and we were able to do that because of the industrial capacity of Detroit. So we really are very much married not only to automobile production, but because we've been there for so long, we have a level of automobility that's greater than anywhere else. And per capita, we have far and away more cars than any other country.
Innovation in the early decades of the 20th century really brings a new level of consumerism to the American automobile. It's beneficial for transportation, of course, but there's always been a transportation need and different means of transportation. But it also becomes a consumer product to be enjoyed. How has that factored into our long, what I guess you would call, fascination with the automobile?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. It's funny. I like to say people who think of cars as a transportation device are missing the point. In a lot of ways, it's a terrible transportation device. You're right. You have to park it. You have to insure it. It's expensive. But it's also very much a consumer product. And this was true early on. It was a way of signaling being part of the middle class. And obviously, even today, you know, if you drive a Lexus instead of a Toyota, you're projecting something about who you are. So in some ways, and particularly as we look to the future of driverless cars and ride hailing, you have to wonder what happens to that component of it.
And what do you think might happen?
Well, to me, that's probably the most difficult question because, for example, Tesla, just recently, Elon Musk said, well, we're going to turn all of our Teslas into robotic cars and people will be able to lend them out. But that doesn't make any sense because that car was built specifically to look good, to feel good, to accelerate quickly. A autonomous car, particularly a ride-hailing car, who cares what it looks like, right? It should look safe. It could be a pod, though. And I think that transforms in a lot of ways the way in which you can sell and what you can sell people when you try to sell mobility that way.
I think it is interesting, though, because on some ride-hailing apps, you can pay a premium to have a fancier car pick you up.
That is true. I get the feeling that's a bit of luxury, and I think that's certainly true. And I certainly could see where, you know, you're buying a ride on an autonomous car that is very much, more comfortable. But, you know, it's not like you're going to get a ride in an autonomous sports car, or particularly need to be right in a red one instead of a black one. I don't think people would care that much.
We're talking with Dan Albert right now. He is the author of Are We There Yet? The American Automobile Past, Present, and Driverless. And Dan, one of the many interesting stories you tell about the history of cars and driving in the United States is how the interstate system changed our country. Can you tell us just a little bit about that?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked, because I think, and people probably have a general sense, you know, your listeners have a general sense of the interstate highway system. And, you know, it's kind of inaugurated in 1956. Over the next 40 years, it's built up. And we think about it as promoting suburbanization. We think about it as improving American freedom. People can travel. And it really is a symbol of kind of the 1950s and popular use of the automobile. In a lot of ways, though, you have to understand this. It's almost like a commuter rail system, right? Now you think about it, you can only get on in certain places. You know, think of an on-ramp as a station, an off-ramp as a station. You're locked in. You know, if you've ever missed your exit, you're like, oh my God, what do I do, right? You can't just turn around. So it really is very much more a controlling system than we think about. Now, the reason for that is in the 1930s, cars were just, they described cars traveling willy-nilly, just going wherever they wanted. And that was a problem. It was a hazard. And so the desire was to create really super safe highways, also highways that would kind of weave the country together. And that's exactly what we did. And it really came out of the 1930s. It took a while to get the thing built. There was a depression. There was the Second World War. But it's the largest public works project in American history by far. So instead of thinking of it as freedom and you know, the go-go 1950s and Dwight Eisenhower, I like to think about it as the 1930s statist ideas, right, that the central government will do a lot to control the economy. And that goes with FDR. So I have a whole chapter in the book called The Hidden History of the Interstate Highway System. And it's the one chapter where I really try to revise standard history.
Well, and that interstate system really made it possible for us to explore this vast country that we live in on those road trips that, of course, the title of your book, Are We There Yet?, you know, harkens back to. And that is such an American tradition, I think.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And one of the things, you know, you have to remember, as you said, people could already get around, right? It's not like the car came along and everybody was like, oh, gee, I couldn't get anywhere before, right? You had ways of getting places. The world was set up so you could walk. There were streetcars and so forth. So one of the early uses of the automobile was to get out into the wilderness, to get out into the countryside, and in particular to the national parks, taking road trips out west. And the first head of the national parks understood that, and he wanted to create an automobile road that connected all of those big western parks. If you look at old photographs, you see people just kind of camping willy-nilly. I mean, you can't imagine it today, but, you know, just park in any meadow in Yosemite or anywhere you wanted. And that really was very much what the car was about. And I shall also say, one of the motivations for the development of the automobile in the 1890s was the bicycle. There was a real bicycle craze. It's kind of hard to imagine now how crazy people were about bicycles. And one of the reasons was you could go ride out into the countryside. You could get out of the city, go have a picnic and whatnot. And that's exactly what people did in the early days of the automobile. And in fact, you know, there's a lot of stories of farmers complaining about these people coming out and picnicking and running over their chickens and, you know, scaring their horses off the road. So that was a huge use of the automobile. And the funny thing is, I will say, you know, we talk about, are we there yet? And I definitely, you know, I've sat in the back of the car. Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Now my kids ask, you know, and I can tell them precisely where we are, when we'll get there. And that's obviously Google Maps and GPS. And that open road and that serendipity and that getting lost, I think, is a lot of ways gone. And that's even before the autonomous car. That's with the ability, before you even leave the garage, to see exactly where you're going and how to get there.
It certainly made us more precise and accurate, but a little bit of the magic has gone.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, you don't get lost anymore. And that's the shame.
We're talking with Dan Albert. He's author of the book, Are We There Yet? The American Automobile Past, Present, and Driverless. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What is or was your first car? How did you feel when you no longer had it? Or maybe you're still driving it. How does car ownership or a lack of it affect your life? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Dan Albert, author of the book, Are We There Yet? The American Automobile Past, Present, and Driverless. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is learning to drive still the rite of passage it once was? Who taught you? And did you teach your kids to drive, or do they rely on mass transit or ride-hailing apps? Or does it vary based on where you're living? And young drivers, where do you stand on the future of driving and cars in our society? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And I want to talk a little bit about the future of cars. You have talked about driverless cars. It's in the title of your book. But it seems like while you are excited about new developments, you're also a little worried about what it does to our relationship to these vehicles that are more than vehicles.
I think that's fair. I will say that I worry when people, you know, there's a car on the front of the book. Obviously, I'm a car guy, but I'm also very critical and understand fully all of the hazards of the automobile, not just climate change and pollution, but also safety. And most importantly, that we've, again, reshaped our world so that in a lot of ways, the only way to get around is by private automobile. You know, the idea of the driverless car and when it's coming, I think, in general, people in the industry have kind of in the last even few months said, oh, gee, this is a lot harder. Driving's a lot harder than we thought it was. And they're always talking about how bad human drivers are. But, you know, maybe we're not so bad. Maybe it's just really hard. But I think the other thing to understand is not so much when they're coming, but why they're coming and why we're getting the particular kinds of cars that we are. And that, to me, is very scary. So the interesting thing about driving for me is you're not at home. The kids aren't pestering you. You're not at work. You don't have to toil. You're doing something else. And it's, in a sense, meditative because you have to pay attention to the road. But you don't have to pay so much attention that your mind can't be on something else. Maybe people are even listening to the radio right now in the car. What happens with the driverless car is you're in the car. You're now able to work. You're accessible to anybody that wants to contact you. And so I really feel that this interstitial space, if you will, this thing that's neither work nor leisure, which is, you know, for all of those bad things I've talked about, pollution and so forth, that act of driving is something outside of kind of commodified leisure and labor. And that goes away, that the automobile, and by the way, driverless cars are still automobiles. They don't do anything for the idea of trying to, you know, reformat the landscape to make it more accessible to other forms of transit. They simply replace the driver. And what that means is you are now perpetually, constantly accessible for people that want you to do some work or that want to sell something to you. And that's, in a way, scary, right? It's the extension of, you know, social marketing, you know, Facebook ads and Google ads and all of that. It just comes into the car, and the car remains one of the few places where that doesn't exist right now.
Let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234. Casey in Rice Lake is up. Hi, Casey.
Yeah, I had a 1965 red Studebaker Daytona. I bought it when I was 18 for $100 so I could go to school and have wheels at UW Eau Claire. And I wish I still had that car because I think it's worth a lot more than $100 now.
And how long did you have the car, Casey?
You know what? I had it 1 year going freshman year, and then my brother needed a car, so he kind of got the car. And then it just kind of sat out in the junkyard, and then it got, trashed. So it was sad. But, the car's worth a lot more. And I love getting lost. I really believe in that getting lost idea. So my husband's a good sport, and he goes and gets lost with me on the back roads of Wisconsin. And you see things you wouldn't ordinarily see just on the regular byways. So we enjoy that.
Well, thank you for that call, Casey. And Dan, that reminds me of the story of a car that you loved, a Saab, that ultimately passed on to your cousin before its untimely end. And it sounds like you and Casey have very similar emotional memories of these cars. And these are just mechanical vehicles, but they really are more than that to us.
I think so. And, first I have to say, Casey, I'm very jealous. Studebaker is one of these independent companies. They were actually the Conestoga wagons. That was Studebaker, the wagons that conquered the West. People emigrated West with them. They were a great company. Paul Hoffman, who was in charge of the company for a lot of the years, was very much about safety. And coming out of World War II, they had gorgeous cars, and they really tried to set the style lead. They were one of the many independents who were kind of crushed by the big three. Speaking of the Saab, I did turn it over actually to my editor at N Plus One. He was one of the founding editors at N Plus One, and I talk about that in the introduction. He needed a car. My mother wanted me to have a better car because we were bringing home a baby, and so I gave it to him. And it's funny. Gorgeous car, Saab, maybe some people know, was Swedish. It was designed, built by what started out as an aircraft company. They built warplanes during the Second World War for Sweden. So it had a lot of strange things about it. Key between the seats, engine was in backwards, and it was beautiful, and it was tight. It was just great to drive, but it was also a very sensible car. Yeah. But beyond all of that, I think one of the great things about it, and is probably true of Casey as well, I did a month and a half trip, my wife and I, traveling across America. And this is before GPS, and we used a map. And so a lot of the warmth and feeling I have toward that car is the going back again to the road trip. We have a lot of memories of that car.
Let's go back to the phones, and Dawson in Black River Falls is up. Hi, Dawson.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I personally just really love getting behind the wheel of my car and just going for a drive. I drive a 07 Dodge Charger. The exhaust is a little louder, which, I mean, some people don't like, but I really just enjoy getting behind the wheel and having the control of driving.
Thanks for that, Dawson. And Dan, I think you would agree with the joy of driving.
I absolutely do. And, Dawson, if you have a Dodge Charger, an 07 Dodge Charger, in fact, I should say that the cover of the book, and this is not my doing, the designer put a Dodge Charger on the cover. It's a custom Dodge Charger, and that is a great car. I love Dodges, and getting behind the wheel, he sounds like a young fella, just like my daughter, and there's still something to be had for driving. And loud exhaust, by the way, is one of the problems with electric cars for people.
Right. It can be dangerous.
Having no sound,
right.
Can be dangerous, and the blind people particularly worry about that. What's funny is some of the newest electric vehicles coming out have engine sounds in the cabin, so you don't have to feel like you're missing out.
Let's go back to the phones, and Jeff in Superior is next. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, I wanted to tell you, when I was in high school, I had a 1960 Volkswagen Beetle, and I think Volkswagen really has captured the American dream. A lot of Volkswagen owners have a relationship with the brand. And my dad was a mechanic with Superior Fire Department, so we had that engine finely tuned to the point where I drove from Superior to Hayward, even though I had a tailwind on Highway 27. We got 80 miles to the gallon going to the cabin in Hayward.
Wow.
Wow, that's brilliant. Yeah, and you're absolutely right about the VW Beetle. And you know, what's interesting about the Beetle is it came in, and I have a picture of the first Beetle imported. And, you know, it came in really around 1949. They tried to import it, and people kind of looked at it, and they said, oh, that's Hitler's car, and it went away. But it came back, and it began to capture a anti-American, if you will. I shouldn't say anti-American, a countercultural vibe, and that was because it wasn't a huge chrome boat. It was small. It was a different ethos than General Motors and Ford and the others. And I think you're absolutely right. Huge brand identity, and you know, obviously the Beetle and also the Volkswagen bus became very much symbols of the counterculture.
And Jeff, thanks for that. Congratulations on making that 70-mile drive on what we're calculating as less than a gallon of gas. Dan, before we wrap up here, what are you hoping we will be able to maintain about the car culture in America when we are still looking to, for instance, protect the environment and be safer on the roads?
My happy vision is that we drive for the fun of it. The problem we have right now is we drive as a country over 3 trillion miles a year, and that's absurd, right? What we should have is great mass transit, walkable neighborhoods, other ways of getting around besides the automobile, and then we could still have driving. You want to take a road trip, you take your car, you go on a road trip. You want to maybe just, you know, take a drive out in the country, you can still do that. It's not so much driving and having automobiles is a problem or that they're especially unsafe. It's that we just use them too darn much.
And we'll have to leave it there. Dan, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, Judith, it's always wonderful to talk cars. Thanks so much.
Thanks. Dan Albert is a writer who covers cars for N+1 magazine. He's the author of a book called Are We There Yet? The American Automobile Past, Present, and Driverless.